This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Today's show is sponsored by Miracle Made. And oh my God, you guys, you know that I love a luxurious set of sheets. And I now have such a set of sheets because of a Miracle Made. They are bedding that has been inspired by NASA. They've got silver-infused fabrics that actually make temperature regulating a thing. So you're not like getting too hot or too cold or whatever, you know, the whole thing that happens with your body's temperature losing its mind. Miracle Made helps with that. One of the little things that my husband particularly loves about Miracle Made is that it like doesn't have as much bacteria as regular sheets because of it's infused with this silver that prevents up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. So it leaves the sheets cleaner for longer. And then the thing for my husband is that it doesn't give him acne, which is like an issue for some people. But more than all of that, it's just luxuriously comfortable and delightful, and it has that cooling feeling while also being cozy. Very hard to achieve those two things at the same time. I mean, Miracle Made, come on, well done. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and buy some sheets today. And if you order today, you can save 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION at the checkout and you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. So there's just a lot of savings here, folks. Order today, you'll get 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION. Go to trymiracle.com/FAKETHENATION. And Miracle's so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not 100% satisfied, which I don't see happening, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and use the code FAKETHENATION to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/fakethenation to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode.
Fake the Nation, episode 267.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and we talk about you, we talk about me, we talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. I am not Nagin Farsad. She is on assignment. She's doing secret Nagin stuff, but I am your guest host, Ben Ari Poulton, and to help me make sense of everything going on this week, I am joined by two absolutely phenomenal human beings. First up, he's a podcast host and producer. You can hear him on his podcast, This Day in Esoteric Political History. Please welcome to the show, Jody Avergan!
Hello there.
Outstanding.
Yeah, it's great. That's all I have to say.
That's all you need.
Is saying that someone is on assignment the most cryptic thing you can possibly say about what they're up to?
1,000%. It just means that they're like, they're not here and it's none It's none your business. That's what it means. and also, friend of the podcast, friend of mine, she's a co-host of the podcast, Were You Raised by Wolves? She's an author of the novel A Holiday Breakdown. It's available on Kindle, so check it out. You've seen her on Late Night with Stephen Colbert. Please welcome back to the show, Leah Bonema!
Hi! Thank you for having
me. Hey! It's great to have you here. This is a great crew, and very excited to talk about our topics. We'll just get right into it. Topic number one. Afghanistan. This is an ever-evolving story, but it's been dominating the headlines this past week. In a way, it has not for 20 years, so at least we have that going for us. Who knew that America's longest war that was probably bungled into early on in the W administration would end so badly? No one could have known that. As longtime Fake the Nation listeners probably know, I spent a little bit of time in Afghanistan, so I will also give you my my disclaimer as a master sergeant in the U.S. Army Reserve and as a veteran of Operation Enduring Freedom and Afghanistan and Iraq vet. My opinions are my own and in no way reflect those of the U.S. Army, our coalition partners, the U.S. government, or anyone real or imagined. That being said, this has been a very complicated, complex, and I think difficult time for the veteran community specifically, but I think also America grappling with the reality of our foreign policy and the way in which we conduct wars. We've never had a war that's lasted this long. This is also a war that has spanned four presidents. This is a war that seemingly could have been ended at several earlier points, but wasn't and kept being extended. So we'll, before I get more into my thoughts, I'm going to throw it out to the panel. Jody, we'll start with you. We've heard a lot from the politicians, but this is to be expected. You know, there's always, yes, it's terrible, but this chaos is to be expected. Was this chaos to be expected?
Well, first off, let me say I have, you know, lots of questions for you more than you may have, you know, and I don't feel like I have answers. I don't think anyone really has answers here, you know, but I'm curious to hear your perspective in particular. But, you know, I think one of the things we've noticed over this last week as this stunning collapse has come is that the people who really know Afghanistan have said, yes, this was to be expected. This is something that we saw the seeds of, you know, and I think it's just interesting to hear when someone says, you know, when someone's moment was to realize that this where we are now was inevitable and we've been heading there. And some people it was 20 years ago, and some people it was 10 years ago, and some people it was 5 years ago, and some people it was a year ago. But I think anyone who was watching closely, this is not a surprise. And I think it's interesting to see the Biden administration, in a sense, try and, in a sense, position it as a surprise, as we never could have seen that, you know, the collapse would have happened this fast, when I think everyone who was being honest about the situation saw the seeds of this planted long ago.
Leah?
I'm so glad you asked me and that this was our first topic, because I was like, I think we can bang this out in 30 to 90 seconds. We can solve this whole
super easy,
no problem. And mirroring what Jody said, I was very much looking forward to hearing your thoughts on this. You know, my initial response obviously was, I can't imagine all the mixed feelings of all of our men and women in the armed forces and how it must feel. And so there was sort of like a sadness for that. And then also for the people of Afghanistan, especially our allies. And then it does seem, obviously I know most of my Afghan knowledge comes from the movie Charlie Wilson's War, with Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts.
Of course.
Which I feel like is a
mine came from Spies Like Us and Rambo 3. So
I'm
glad we're sending you out into the field.
is that it did seem that people are basically like, either we were going to stay there forever or this was inevitable. And it does seem like, because of the world we live in now with social media and everybody's so quick to point fingers and blame instead of being like, how do we handle something that is just in itself tragic? You know what I mean? As opposed to just being like, it's their fault. It's like, can we just do the best we can handling this? That's what my wish would be.
This has been interesting because I think there was a pretty wide, broad consensus that America's own Infinity War had to come to an end. So ending the war and bringing the troops home was very popular. This was actually a decision made by the previous administration with a deal that was hammered out back in 2019 and then started coming to fruition in 2020 and was put into place with an actual pullout deadline of May, the end of May, which the Biden administration came in. That was like 3 months into his administration. They did some negotiations to kind of push it to the end of August. I think the August 31st was sort of an arbitrary date pulled out because they wanted it to be over by the 20th anniversary of September 11th. That being said, the logistics of doing something like this are messy. Because as soon as it starts, chaos erupts. You know, as soon as you start sending people home, chaos erupts. And as we've sort of seen, there were wires and emails earlier going back saying, hey, you might want to think about going. And a lot of people who were on the ground didn't want to give up the mission. There were a lot of people working in the State Department. There were a lot of people at the embassy who just refused to just up and leave. They whether they're working with Afghan nationals on the ground, trying to get working the visa issues that was backlogged because of a lot of things that happened in the previous administration and over the past 20 years, all of the logistical problems, they didn't want to leave until they were forced to leave. And now it's a question of getting everyone out. One thing that's been interesting is the initial chaos, which was terrifying and frightening and did take everyone by surprise. The ability for us to move tens of thousands of people out as quickly as we have just in the past couple of days has been extraordinary. And so I think there can be some criticism leveled at how we allowed that to sort of blow up both figuratively and literally and allow such good optics for the Taliban. But it's also sort of lit a fire under everyone's asses and was like, hey, we got to do this and no time to think about it now. Just get people on planes, do it. We're working with allied countries, working with coalition partners. You know, I don't think if we had not seen that chaos erupt, it would have been much more difficult to convince a lot of these other countries to be accepting refugees at the rate they're accepting them. And also us, we're sending refugees to Fort Bliss, Fort Lee, Fort McCoy right now. We're bringing them into the U.S. And I think had we not seen that, there would have been a lot more pushback and a lot more talk about, well, we got to get the refugees out, but where are we going to put them? Jody?
Yeah, no. Yeah, I think I take that point. And I think it is part of kind of interesting how quickly a relatively effective, given, you know, relatively effective strategy has gone into place for extracting people just in the last few days, as you said. But, you know, I think there's potentially a flip side to that, which is that no matter at what point you flip the switch and said, you know, the pullout is starting, there was going to be chaos. And it's like, you know, I think this argument that you hear of, well, it's not exactly that we got out, but it's how we got out and the timing of it and the details of it and the execution of it. Sure, there can be criticism there. But I mean, if we're talking about a 20-year process that was undermined in the course of a month, I don't think, you know, the specific Jenga piece that you happen to pull out at what particular moment is really what the conversation should be about. This thing was going to collapse regardless, whether it was 2 months ago, a month from now, some of the specifics that we're discussing. So yes, I think there's a conversation, but I think, you know, we have to take a step back and think about that 20-year process and why it failed. And, you know, I have some thoughts on that. I'm sure you do too. But can I just ask you one quick question? And then, but you know, I'm just curious, you know, I sort of mentioned at the beginning that I've been hearing people who know this space much better than I do say that they had their moment at some point over the last 20 years where they said, oh, what's happening in the summer of 2021 is inevitable where this is headed. I'm curious if you had one of those moments.
Yes, I've had a couple of those moments. I was in the service on 9/11. I was on a deployment during the invasion of Iraq. And I remember when the invasion of Afghanistan started, I thought, oh, this is surprising that this particular administration, the W administration, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, that they had gotten the coalition partners, had gone in, had routed al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan, gotten the Taliban, and seemed to be doing what they said they were going to be doing. And then they reverted to character and went into their excursion into Iraq. And I remember March 20th being a date where I said, well, this is where we messed up Afghanistan. And the fact that, you know, that Osama bin Laden had been on the run for that long, that we sort of took our eye off that prize, a lot of people had said, okay, well, now we're fighting wars on two fronts and we're not really sure, why are we still here, et cetera. But when I deployed to Iraq in 2009 and then I deployed to Afghanistan in 2011, months after we killed Osama bin Laden. And the feeling on the ground then was I was part of a logistics unit where we were doing our drawdown. At that point, we were then figuring out how we are logistically going to, what are we going to do with the things we leave behind, what equipment we're going to bring back, what are we, humanitarian issues, and dealing with coalition partners who now were leaving. Canada left, the Romanians, you know, were leaving, the Australians were lowering their presence, the Brits were lowering their presence. So we didn't do that. We actually increased our presence as opposed to drawing down during that time. And I think that if there was a time to leave cleanly, that was the moment. Once you killed Osama bin Laden, that's a thing everyone can say, hey, we did it. And then if Afghanistan broke down months later, no one would have even been watching, really. And they would say, well, that's what's going to happen to that country. Right. So I think that we snatched chaos out of victory every moment that we had opportunities to cleanly, you know, leave. Because look, this isn't World War II. There was never going to be a victory, you know, a VE Day. There was never going to be, you know, the victory over Japan. There's never going to be that sort of celebration in Times Square with this. We started out this war trying to fight it on the cheap. We kept extending, you know, they were playing games. And then it became a money train for a lot of people. And I think that a lot of what's happening is, you know, you'll talk to people on the ground. They're like, you know, we're only here to keep the mission going. We're here. We're going on missions to find insurgents who are attacking us because we're here. And so the cycle just keeps going.
The forever war is the mission.
And I think that, you know, what's very difficult for people to process is you can know that. Having been there, I kind of knew that there and came home, but was proud of the work I'd done working with the locals there, training the people. It's very difficult to see in reality it fall apart when you put your blood, sweat, and tears, time, sacrifice into that. It's still difficult to process. And I think the toll on the veteran community is going to be very long-term. And I think it's going to be psychologically damaging in the rift between the military and the civilian. And I'll throw this to you, Leah. There's a cynical part of me that really thinks this was also part of the calculation, because the time in August, this is sort of a dead news time. Football is going to start up in a couple of weeks. they're about to pass a $3.2 trillion infrastructure bill. We're going to get back into the politics of politics very shortly. If there was a time to weather sort of a crisis from a war that most of the country has not paid attention to for 20 years, what are the chances that in 2 months they're still going to be thinking about this? Was this a cynical calculation of like, it's going to be chaos, but it's going to be a couple of weeks and then we're going to be on to the next thing. It's not going to impact the timing of it now is sort of the best timing politically. It's not going to impact next year's midterms. It's not going to impact election cycles. It's not going to impact a lot of other things. So was this a political decision?
You know me, I even though I am constantly thinking everybody's garbage, I'm never a cynic, which is like an interesting middle ground to walk. So also because, as you mentioned, the prior administration sort of set these wheels in motion for this time frame. You know, Benari, I would like to say no. I feel like the Biden administration, and I see so many people criticizing the Biden administration, and we could just break those criticisms up over the 20 years of all of us collectively not being informed, not doing this, like letting things go for, like, obviously, as we said, dark money, Halliburton, like all these reasons, and discuss it as like as a group of what we could have done better, instead of just like laying blame and putting our focus on the veteran community and the Afghani people who were our allies. So I would like to believe that no, this wasn't a news cycle why we left at this point, but just because the Biden administration felt like we have to go. There's a timeline. We got to start doing it. And there's 900 crises happening and I'm just following this timeline. That's what I really hope. But you know, yeah. I'm from Northern Maine and I have bought pie off people's lawns where it's like drop $25 in the slot and get it on the honor system. So I might not be. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Hey, well, I do.
I mean, we've also been lied to this entire time. So like, why would we not be lied to now? Do you know what I mean?
And there's that.
And there's that. That's what I was going to point out.
But also it's like, is that what I want to focus on in this? And I think it's not what I personally want to focus on. It's like, who can I listen to better understand what people are dealing with? Where can I do anything, you know what I mean? How can I greater understand the situation? I feel like that is where I put my energy to be a better listener, learner, advocate for people, as opposed to being like, oh, this is all just a part of it. Because I don't really get anything out of thinking that way. I can't in any way move forward being a cynic in a helpful way, which is what I really want to do.
I mean, to that point, I mean, I do think and hope. No, I hope. I don't actually think it would happen. But I do hope that, you know, that this is a chance to ask some really fundamental questions about our goals and, you know, what the goal in Afghanistan really was, what the goal of modern wars really are. And, you know, I spent much of this last year working on a series called The Line, which was about this guy, Eddie Gallagher, who was accused of war crimes in Iraq, and he's a Navy SEAL. And putting aside Eddie Gallagher, this series that I worked on, you know, we interviewed hundreds of special forces and Navy SEALs, and really, I think, got a picture, and it emerged to me as the real story, you know, of how modern wars are fought and how we go into these countries, especially Iraq and Afghanistan, and we put special ops in a position to do traditional warfare, and we set them up in impossible situations for, at the micro level and at the macro level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then we match that up against goals like we want to help a country build a democratic society and develop, right? But we're sending in special forces to be the tip of the spear to help accomplish that, you know? And nowhere in there are there conversations about what it takes to actually have a civil society, like free elections or anti-corruption initiatives or development work, which sounds like a lot of what you were doing, you know? And so I think if we can convene the conversation, if only on, you know, smart podcasts like this about what our actual goals are, and how we're actually waging these wars and whether those match up, maybe this is a chance to ask some of those questions.
Well, and it's, I think, a topic like this, it's such a visceral topic, right? And it's a topic where you have a lot of people, and I think this is a longer-term problem in this particular country in how we fight wars, because one of the strongest mechanisms and one of the strongest checks and balance on a war lasting this long used to be the draft. Yeah. That was the thing that would trigger the American population's relationship to the war into finally saying, hey, this isn't worth it to us. For good intentions, that was removed after Vietnam. But now we rely on less than 1% of the American population to fight and win America's wars. And I think what the last, I think unfortunately, one of the lessons that's been learned from the last 20 years is, yeah, we can do this as long as we want. And we can send these, we can send our volunteer military now to hotspots all over the world, and we can move them around and they can bear the burden. And 99% of the country won't even know what's happening.
Won't feel it. It's hidden.
They won't
feel it. That's exactly right. And I mean, to me, you know, I think if you're going to get angry about something around that, it's the civilian leadership that knows that and cynically exploits that, you know, and I think that's where a lot of the blame has to fall here. Sure, there were tactical military mistakes, but it is the civilian leadership playing a game over the last 20 years with their military and putting people like you, you know, in impossible situations.
And I think that we, you know, we heard this refrain 2 decades ago, but, you know, we went to war, but the country went to the mall. Right. And that started at the leadership level with George W. Bush. That was Dick Cheney. That was Donald Rumsfeld. And I think as we close out this particular segment, it's very important to remember that when we talk about long-term ramifications of decision makers in those positions, these are the long-term ramifications. It doesn't happen overnight. Just because it's 20 years after they left, you know, that they started this, doesn't mean that this isn't what they grew. This isn't the garden that they grew. This is the garden that they grew. They planted these seeds. They set this into motion, and they set this up for this sort of chaos because they didn't do the things up front that we should have done. We didn't ask the rest of the country to bear any burden, pay any price. There was no taxes on corporations. There's no war taxes. We didn't build victory gardens. We didn't have a unified front so that we felt like there was a common purpose here. And that allowed for this to sort of fester and grow, I think, over the decades.
And you would think that at the bare minimum, we would, as a country, have set up a good caretaker system for our vets when they come home with, like, amazing health care, job retraining. And also, like, I have so many friends whose families have become caretakers of returning. And then to be a caretaker is its own stress. And there should be, like, mental health, you know, of people that can they can reach out to. It obviously should be covered by taxpayers. You know what I mean? That's not even set up, which should be bare minimum. How we take care of our troops when they come home. And you would hope that we would, like, speak to that larger problem of, as you were saying, we don't notice. It's a small, I mean, we do notice, but it's not paid attention to at the point of what it should be. And then the larger question, completely separate, of what's America's responsibility, which I think is, like, a whole other topic, but that we've never had that conversation openly because it always ends up being about other things.
Right. Whether or not you kneel for the national anthem, and we argue over a football game instead of the actual war.
Yeah, so it's like sometimes I just wish we could have a conversation about what are our responsibilities in other countries, because it always ends up being about money and our vested mm-hmm. interests, as opposed to, do we morally want to spend money going into places when we also have money that needs to be spent here to take care of our people, where people are being victimized, or, you know, and I think that's also a very important conversation to have.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, to take it back to pure politics, I mean, you know, if Joe Biden last fall said, I'm going to take us out of foreign war so that we can build up our infrastructure here at home, maybe that's what's happening.
Right. and there we go.
And that's likely the case that they will be making, you know.
Absolutely. So I think we are where we are, and I'm glad we solved that.
Yeah, solved.
Fantastic. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, topic number two.
Today's show is sponsored by Prose. This is kind of, I feel like, you know, I'm on some sort of Lord of the Rings journey trying to figure out skincare. And I feel like this customized skincare line is really got my name on it. Basically, every bottle of Prose custom hair care and skincare, I tried the skincare just recently, is made to order and it's personalized. It's got a unique blend of naturally powerful and proven effective ingredients to meet your needs, like specifically you. And then the way they do it is you take this great, like, in-depth quiz, basically. They analyze over 80 factors for a complete view of your life, your beauty goals. Like I have oily skin that's also dry, which is just a fun little conundrum. I live in New York City. Like, we've got these four seasons. My face gets weird during seasonal shifts. All of these things I got to kind of talk about in answering the questions. The other fun thing was they asked us at the end, like, do you like a creamy type of moisturizer or like a less creamy kind? And I was kind of like, I think like less creamy. And they were like, that's fine. Like, you can do that, but we think for your skin type, creamier is better. And I never knew that. So I love that there's so much kind of personal information that goes into creating this. I got my stuff in the mail very quickly after. I got a wonderful serum. Like I said, this very creamy moisturizer. And this also very just delectably creamy cleanser that just kind of feel like I think it's possible that I've been washing my face with just like harshness. For like many years, because when I saw this cleanser, I was like, oh, is this what it's supposed to feel like? It's supposed to feel like a little bit of a delight on my face. That's not what I've been doing. So I don't know, guys. And here's the thing, you don't have to take my word for it. In a third party, double blind, dermatologist supervised controlled clinical study, which is like the gold standard for research studies, Pros prove that personalization works better than off-the-shelf alternatives, which just sort of totally makes sense on a just logical level if you think about it. Just it makes common sense. Pros is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% of your first subscription order at pros.com/FakeTheNation will be taken off. That's pros.com/FakeTheNation. You get your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formulas. Again, that's pros.com/FakeTheNation. Go and get your just super personalized, luxurious skincare products and hair care products. That's what I'm going to try next. So pros.com/FakeTheNation. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a roundabout 8 exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation.
And we're back. It's time for topic number two, California recall. All right. Leah, you like myself are a new recent sort of transplant to the West Coast, to California. And, you know, the real question here is, what's the deal with the California recall of Governor Newsom? This is kind of an interesting story because it's only the second time a recall effort has been successful. Partly that was helped by an extension that was given to the folks who had to get the signatures. They were given like a longer extension to get those signatures, but it only requires 12% of the California electorate who had voted in the previous election in five different counties to sign paperwork to trigger a recall. And unlike other recalls, if Gavin Newsom doesn't get at least 50% of the vote, which is a no vote on the recall, if he doesn't survive, if he gets less than, he could get 49%, if he gets less than 50% on this one recall, whoever's next in line becomes the governor on that ballot.
With like
and that
11%.
Person could get like 10%. there's a million and a half people on the ballot, and so someone
You guys on there? I got in. I threw my name on last time. I just figured. Why not?
Why not? Exactly.
It's Wikipedia line. It'll be nice. You know, it'll be there.
Yeah.
I love how the top running person is always the person who thinks that women are like farm animals. It's always like, it's going to be a TV commentator who thinks that women shouldn't have productive rights. And if we could just put them in a garage somewhere and milk them, that would be like best for society. It's like always, why is it that person? Do you know what I mean? Who's next in line? Get your ballots and put them in the mailbox.
It's the marketplace of ideas. Okay. Oh, we're just throwing ideas out there and seeing which ones are popular.
Can you get a breast exam at Walgreens? These are the questions we want from such a person. But I moved here in the spring and I registered right away and I just put my ballot in the mailbox. And it's never straight. You just vote on the first question. I think nobody's like, you know, getting a lady chub for Newsom, but you just don't want anybody else. Just, you know what I mean? I think that's really what it is. Nobody's excited, but it's just like, just show up and vote. We just got to show up and vote.
Right.
First off, let me say that I can't help but think of our previous conversation about Afghanistan. And if in there, you know, the conversation was, well, we failed to bring American style democracy to this burgeoning country. You know, it's like, well, maybe, do you want that style of democracy? If we turn to California and we see exactly what's, maybe our democracy isn't so hot.
Yeah.
But you know,
how about we give them Larry Elders? Yeah, can we just give Afghanistan Larry Elders?
But you know, I'm curious. You know, I think Democrats and Newsom's camp is really embracing and playing what is a, look, all of this is messed up. But you know, what is a tricky strategic play here, which is to encourage people to just vote no on the recall and then that be it. Whereas, you know, the way that it works is if you vote no on the recall, you can still go and vote for who you would vote for if enough people vote yes on the recall. It's, you know, it's, I just confused myself saying this and it's not that hard. But basically it's like if enough people get yes, then it goes to whoever. But you know, the ploy is that they want to basically set it up as Newsom versus Republicans. Not another name, not another person whose ideas you have to weigh against, but it's just Newsom versus GOP Trumpy takeover. And I'm curious how you feel like that strategy is playing. You know, and it's different from previous strategies that have been used in recall elections.
Well, it's interesting to bring that up. We actually got an email from a fan of the show, Kelsey Poole, a longtime listener of the Fake the Nation podcast, and she actually asked about this. She said a lot of official Democratic Party people are advising voters to vote no, but then to leave the candidate choice blank. But she goes on to say, others say that if liberals don't vote for a candidate, then this would open the door to a conservative candidate winning if the recall does pass. She says, I've gotten into some arguments with friends over this and was wondering if you have an opinion that'd be more effective. The polls are pretty even. I'm worried that this will get some anti-science crackpot who will undo all our COVID restrictions. And they say, thank you, you know, for the wonderful show. So since it's a wonderful show, since you mentioned the strategy, I think that Governor Newsom's strategy has been to be simple, because as soon as you start explaining the rest of it, the most important thing is vote no. Everything else is basically immaterial. So I think there's a strategy of just keeping it simple, which is something the Democrats aren't very good at. Mm-hmm. They like to over-explain things and tell you all the reasons why. And Newsom's campaign is just saying, vote no, that's it. As you said, this is Newsom versus the GOP. But it's also an all-or-nothing strategy, correct? Yes. There is no safety net here. So that being the case, they are counting on turning out their base. And what I'm less – so I think the messaging is good about just vote no. But what I'm concerned about is low voter turnout, which historically, especially in California on off elections and special elections and weird elections, is usually very low. And so I think that there needs to be an element, and maybe this is part of the strategy too, of getting people amped up and scared so that they actually vote in this particular special election. But I think that to get through the confusion, they've kept it simple and just said, all you need to know is vote no.
Yeah.
Well, and that I think is where this might be an interesting test or sign of how much of the Trump era Democratic fervor is still left. Because if it were to do the more complicated thing of, well, we have Newsom, but you know, there's another Democrat who we recommend if you're going to vote against Newsom, but instead to say the clarity of, no, what the decision in front of you is basically Newsom, a Democrat, versus all your fears from the last 4 years of, you know, of the Trump-led GOP. It'll be very curious to see if that sort of drives enthusiasm and you get that sort of, I mean, you know, so much of the vote in 2016 in 2020 and over the last 4 years was a sort of whipped up anti-Trump vote. And if that's still out there, maybe the sort of fervor as you characterized it will be enough to sustain. And maybe that's part of the strategy.
Leah, were you confused at all by what's happening, or did you see it as just a very, you know, straightforward? We gotta keep Newsom because the GOP's clearly trying to play with the election here.
I saw it as a straightforward. We just gotta keep Newsom. It's what is it? Just a year and change,
right?
Right.
It just seemed like the most straightforward. And I always think the game is getting people to vote. You know, and I in an ideal world, we would be like, well, who's my backup plan? Whose ideologies are good? Who would be a good thing for California? But I think that right now it's just like, especially there's so much happening in the world to get people's in politics, to get people's attention, to be like, you got to register, you got to make sure you got to put it in the ballot box. I think that's what they've done. They've like, it's as Jody said, it's Newsom versus all of these horrible things. Make sure you show up. And so.
And to your point, I mean, yes, at the end of 2022, there is going to be a proper election where if Democrats want to have their overthinking it Democratic conversation about Newsom versus some other person and the perfect being enemy, you know, good, and yada, 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 they can have that in a year and a half. And I think the flip side of that is it's incredibly cynical, but I think it's clear that Republicans feel like the only way they can win a statewide election in California is by doing this, that they are not going to win in a 1v1 election, you know, next year. And so this is the only way they're going to sneak someone in.
So funny, huh? I don't find that part cynical. I mean, the other word, I'm like, I'm not cynical, but I'm like, that's just facts.
That's facts.
That's just facts. Yeah, but facts can make you cynical.
Well, are we underreporting the what seems to be on the local level, the very determined GOP strategy of win by any means necessary? And, you know, I think a lot of times we can dismiss these things as, well, it's so obvious what they're trying to do, but it doesn't matter if they're still doing it. It seems like these efforts, and in California, it's a recall, they got a recall election. They successfully got a recall election. In you know, 20 other states, the Republican legislatures have effectively legally changed the laws to make it more difficult for people to vote in areas. We see this battle for voting rights happening on the national level, where we need to get where Democrats are trying to push through voting rights legislation to sort of protect themselves or to protect the electorate from shenanigans like this. But you know, elections seem to really be decided at the local level, mm-hmm. and it seems like the Republicans are just better at it.
They are better
and
at
are
it.
Are we sort of dismissing that organization out of hand, that they are willing to put the time in to this and to get it done where some of these battles are won? Because, yeah, it's just a year, but you can do a lot of damage in a year.
Oh, yeah.
Laws can be changed. If something happens to Senator Feinstein, who's the oldest member of the Senate, then you would have a Republican who appoints the replacement senator. There's a lot of things that can be thrown out of whack just by this one, you know, this 1 year period of time. Not to mention, you know, sure, you know, they're going to have to, whoever becomes governor or if Newsom survives the recall, he'll still have to deal with a Democratic legislature. But there's all sorts of things that get thrown out of whack. And now there's fights you have to fight. So are we discounting the Republicans' ability to really organize at the local level and be successful?
I think that we as a large, if I can speak for the, as the Democratic community, we've all noticed that the Republicans are, if we're just grouping everybody, are by any means necessary. And I feel like more often than not, the Democrats were dialoguing what's fair, what's mm-hmm. just. And that's while they're moving forward. You know what I mean? They get behind mm-hmm. a point, they just push it forward. While we're so until we address this way that we handle things so differently, do you know what I mean? I think we've mm-hmm. agreed. Yeah, they're doing by anything that's necessary, but then we're talking about it. You know what
right.
I mean? As opposed
this
to being like
moral conscience.
Yeah, our moral conscience is just really, right. I don't know, getting in our way. We're like, what's legal? We're weighing in people's opinions. You know what I mean? And that's the difference. And so it's like right now, because of that, I think we all agree that that is the dichotomy. Yeah. We just got to show up and vote. And for the next election, we can like weigh in on all these things. But because the Republican Party does seem better at just at a local level, they also have like target issues where they will vote for a person who's complete garbage because they weigh in on one side of one issue, which mm-hmm. so they mobilize. You know what I mean? So it's like, mm-hmm. I think we all have sort of agreed they mobilize. So we should just also mobilize, vote no on this. And then for the next round, we can have conversations.
I think it is important to recognize that Republicans and Democrats are playing, you know, different games and have different strategies. And it is important at every stage to sort of fight to win. But I think it is equally as important, I think it's more important, to also just point out that it is a rigged game. And, you know, especially this California recall. I mean, this is such a screwed up system. And I think, mm-hmm. like, it feels futile to say that, and it feels like naive to point that out, but I think you just have to keep hammering away at that, at how messed up this system is, how mm-hmm. screwed up our national elections are run, how screwed up our local elections
right.
are run. And until there is an honest conversation around structural change, you know, which I actually think is happening, and it's one of the mm-hmm. few sort of hopeful things in this moment, is I think people are actually starting to ask those fundamental questions. That's where the change is going to happen, because as long as it's a rigged game, one side, and it's often Republicans, are going to be happy to play it. And so what we have to do is change the nature of the game.
Well, I think that actually brings up such an excellent point, because I think one of the things that's panicking the GOP currently is, especially under the Biden administration and under Nancy Pelosi's like laser focus on voting rights right now,
right.
Is that there's an understanding that structurally it needs to be changed. And they're not doing the hearts and minds argument that Democrats normally make. They're saying, no, this is things that need to be enshrined in law, because that's the structure of things. And I think for a long time, Republicans have been very good at ignoring the hearts and minds part and just being like, yeah, we all know the game is rigged. Oh, but I'm still voting for my one candidate in this rigged election. And Democrats can fight over whether we should take part in the system or not, or do we wait for a better system and things like that. And so I think your point about, you know, knowing how the game is played and how it's rigged, you gotta win that part first.
Yeah.
And then you can fix it, and then you can change it. So I think this conversation about the structural changes that need to happen, there needs to be an understanding of what needs to happen before we can make those structural changes and not just complain about it.
And I do feel like the last election, you know, I think we've all been sort of thinking about voting rights for a long time, but it really, really brought it to the forefront of people who maybe somehow weren't aware that we have voting rights problems in this mm-hmm. country. And I think that, you know, that's where we should be focusing.
Right. And I think that that also is so essential when you start saying like, well, the people voted for this, what's wrong with them? And then you start looking at the data, and in some places it's like, oh, that election was decided by 30% of the registered voters who came out on this off-cycle election, and this percentage
in fucking Wisconsin
were,
in one county.
Yeah.
And the whole thing gets decided by these three people, and you're like, it's not fair.
No. And so of course it's insane. And that's, you know, that then the cycle begins anew. So I think understanding.
Worth pointing out, Alabama has a Democratic senator for much the same reasons, right? A very
absolutely
a special election in a wonky scenario. But yes, most often than not, it, you know.
Absolutely. Because they took the same strategy of that's how Scott Brown in Massachusetts became a senator for a couple of years. You know, that you take advantage of the off cycle. So that's also politics. All right. Fantastic. Again, solve that issue. Fantastic.
Done. What's the next one?
But, and just to close it out, I think the strategy, though, I think there's a consensus that just vote no, straight no on that ballot. If you live in California, just vote no for the recall.
And then we'll figure it out after.
And then we'll figure it out. All right. Topic number three. Big news in the social media world. OnlyFans came out a little while ago saying that it was going to ban sexually explicit content. And they were the latest digital platform to crack down on what would be considered pornographic material, adult material, sexual content. But it was a source of income for millions of people during the coronavirus pandemic, especially for sex workers who couldn't do face-to-face in person. And so that became a good site for sex workers to keep making money. Today, it's come out that there has been a stunning reversal, and they now say that they have suspended, and I'm putting that in quotes, suspended plans to ban pornography. The CEO came out, so it's a London-based company, and they had given one of the reasons for cracking down on explicit content being that they were having trouble with their backers. The CEO called out some of the banks, Metro Bank, JP Morgan, saying that, you know, it's them, it's not us. But now say that they've settled things with their backers and people can continue using their site. That, of course, also came from after huge backlash from the users who started making plans to use other platforms. So, Leah, what do you think led to this reversal? Was this a groundswell of support for sex workers' rights? Or is this just purely financial on OnlyFans saying, oh, there goes our cash cow?
Well, I think it's money. And I love the wording they use. It was like, I think it was, they secured assurances for money for their creative community, which is basically everybody coming forward being like, what do you think we're on there for? Your entire base. Are you out of your minds? Which I enjoyed watching all those videos that people did. I thought some of the memes were amazing. And then I'm always happy for people to throw banks under the bus, whether or not they just flipped with their narrative and wanted to blame other people so they looked good. I don't care. Throw those banks under the bus. They could always take a bus throwing. You know what I mean? Why not?
Throw all the buses.
Why not?
Any story in which you can just get mad at a bank is, it's nice to get on board with that. Yeah.
But I woke up to and I saw that in the news this morning. I was like, I really laughed out loud because I think when we all saw the initial announcement, we were like, who do you think is paying for your platform? Where do you think your money's coming from?
Right. That's insane. Was, of course, the sort of ridiculous catch-22 at the heart of all this, which was we're not going to be able to raise the money to get the valuation that we think because banks are skittish about what we do. But obviously that valuation is only based on the fact that you do what you do. And so taking it away was going to make the whole thing fall apart. And I think we've seen it time and time again, companies try and be something else or pivot or, whatever word you want to use. And it's like, no, you're generally good at one thing and you should do that one thing until you can't do that one thing anymore. You should fight to do that one thing. And the idea that you can just do something else and have it be just as valuable or effective is absurd.
There's something interesting here though too, because so I think last year they reported there was like 130 million users, 2 million content creators, and they reported like over $150 million in free cash flow, right?
I think it's $300.
And then they decided they wanted to and so then they wanted to go legit, and they were going to do that, by basically banning all the people that allowed them to raise all that money. And I think when it was presented, very starkly the way you both presented it, saying like, where do you think the money's coming from? This doesn't exist without that. Is this a turning point in the way in which especially sex workers, because a lot of the conversation has revolved around sex, what constitutes sex work, what the legitimacy of that as a profession is, all of that, and our relationship to pornography. It's funny, it's a London-based company, and probably the only people more uptight about sex than Americans are the British. Is this a turning point in our collective social misgivings about the seediness of pornography?
Yes. That's really the heart of this story is, why the fundamental question is why were banks so skittish about supporting a pornographic site, are we not at the point where we can have a nuanced enough conversation to recognize that creators, sex workers, creators making, taking agency and making money for themselves is different from some of the other trickier and seedier conversations about pornography, and that a bank, even if they're thinking in the most cynical way possible, we just want to make money, how can a bank not distinguish and find that nuance? I think that's really the heart of this story.
I do think it's so interesting. And this is always, but banks will be like, hey, I'll invest in these things that are like openly killing people. Yeah. But you know what, if this woman at home wants to like make a solid living and pay her bills and take care of her family and there's a tit in there, I'm going to flag it because, and that's always been the, even with ratings and, as Jody said, it is a great, like these are, if you want to have conversations about pornography on like a larger, but this is like actually creators at home. A lot of the things you want to talk about don't even, this is people at home making their own money, creating their own content.
Can I point out two great wrinkles to this story?
Yes.
So one is, in that interim when OnlyFans had removed full pornography, there was only one social media platform left on which full nudity and pornography actually was allowed. Do you know which one it was?
No.
Twitter. I would not have guessed that was the last bastion of full pornography. Tumblr got rid of it. Instagram got rid of it.
Ted Cruz could have told you that.
Yeah, well, that's true. my other favorite little thing is that in this interim, OnlyFans released a safe for work app called OFTV where you could upload nudity-free content. And I just want, give it 3 weeks. I want some enterprising reporter. Just go check in on, see how OFTV is doing. Just see if there's people still on there doing cooking classes or, shopping tips or whatever. But I just think it's going to be out there. I'm very curious to see what their numbers are like.
this is like sort of related, but I didn't realize that there was nudity on Twitter and I didn't have my age in there. And then I had to upload my license to prove, somebody like started a fake account. I had to upload my license to prove that I was me or whatever. So then as soon as my age came on, I didn't realize that Twitter was blocking things from me seeing them because they didn't know that I was over 18 or whatever. So then I log in and
New world opened up.
My whole timeline is like pornography. And I was like, I don't know. And like hardcore pornography. And of course, once you start, it's a hole. You're in it. You know what I mean? No pun intended. You're just like going. And then I was here there and I was like, how did I not know? And then I realized it was my age. And I don't know when I started following everybody. Like I'm totally happy to support people in the sex industry, obviously, but I just don't know how I followed without realizing. And I realized it's all these people that I'm in the same political groups with. And I was only seeing their political tweets. And really there was like all this like hardcore effing going on. And I was like, oh my God, Twitter is so much more fun than I realized. But it was so funny because I just opened up my app one day and it was like a completely different timeline. And I'm following a very specific kind of porn and I didn't realize it. And I was like, what did I? But it's a delight. Let me just say it's a delight.
I love that you like might have just been in like a like, you know, we love Han Solo and Hillary Clinton. And like, and then you're like, wait, you're also in porn. Like you're just
that's
in a
really
group.
What it was. It was my main, like my main naivete. And ironically, Benari, that's exactly what it was. It was a Star Wars group and a Hillary Clinton group. You nailed it. And that's, I mean, you really did. That's
I mean,
exactly
we probably follow some of the same people. So I think I know what you're looking at.
And they are talented. I literally was like, did you guys know this was on here? I'm like showing my, they're like, everybody knew it was on here, Leah. How old are you?
So wait, Star Wars folks are Clinton folks. They're not Bernie folks.
Well, the Star Wars people I was following were Hillary Clinton people. I'm sure.
I think it depends whether you're OG trilogy, whether you're prequel people, you might be the new the sequels, Mandalorian. I think everyone has like their own subcategory. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty large galaxy to explore.
And there's something
for everyone in Star Wars.
Oh my goodness.
So I think it's an interesting thing where money finally, I think people also were very vocal about it, surprisingly. Like there were so many people who just came out in support when this was announced by OnlyFans of, you know, in ways like people, I think, griped about it when Tumblr was going to do it, but no one really wanted to say that's what they were on Tumblr for. But all the other, you know, barriers were sort of removed with like, why do you think we have OnlyFans? That's literally what it's for. Why would you do this?
And people are like, I'm making my living.
There was a comfort level. Yeah, but I think there was a comfort level with people openly talking about their OnlyFans accounts or following OnlyFans accounts.
But it's because that was interesting. It's because you couldn't talk your way around it. Like when Tumblr went away, people were walking around being like, "Huh, why did Tumblr go away? That's funny." Yeah. Everyone was on Tumblr and everyone was not. It's like, well, they got rid of pornography and like 80% of their business disappeared overnight. Like, I mean, you know, and it's like so much of, and so this one, you can't talk your way around it. You can't explain it away.
Well, fantastic. Well, again, glad we solved that. Final thoughts on the thing. So I think, you know, money drives it, but also maybe we can have a more adult conversation now about the ways in which we allow people to make money. And maybe because the banks see that this is lucrative, maybe like people in other types of jobs, maybe we'll start getting loans. Maybe there's a safer way to start, you know, for these communities to make money in a safer and more supportive community. I mean, hopefully that opens the doors there too.
I like that flip side of cynicism. We're like, well, if it is about money, maybe the banks will realize, oh, we should just invest in this and then allow people to have this, as you're saying, safe, supported. I got to get a loan. You know, I'm going to run my own business. I got to have my own protections. You know what I mean? Which would be fantastic because it's ridiculous how we demonize the sex industry in this country.
Well, if a sex worker can go to a bank as opposed to a loan shark.
Exactly.
Or have to do like that. That's good for the banks. It's good for the workers. It's, you know, now you're investing in the economy. You're a small business owner. I mean, it's great. Everybody wins.
Yeah.
Everybody wins.
I want to support all skill sets. You know what I mean?
It's a big galaxy.
It's a big galaxy.
Room for everyone. All right. Fantastic. Well, that does it for this episode. How do you guys feel?
I feel quite good. I think we solved three of the world's pressing crises.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness we just knocked those out.
Fantastic. Well, Jody, where can our listeners find you?
People can find my show at thisdaypod.com. It's from the Radiotopia Network. And we come out, do three short episodes a week talking about interesting moments in political history. So thisdaypod.com.
Fantastic. And Leah, where can people find you?
You can follow me on all the socials at Leah Bonema, L-E-A-H-B as in Bravo, O-N-N-E-M-A. And then on my Instagram, all my links are there.
Fantastic. I can be found on all the socials at Benari Lee, B-E-N-A-R-I-L-E-E. Instagram, Twitter. Don't have an OnlyFans yet, but now with this breaking news, that might change, so... We'll see if that's a moneymaker for me.
My OnlyFans would literally just be me talking about Lord of the Rings. So people would be like, we have no interest in you. You could have done that on Instagram.
There's a lot of places you can stick a ring, though, is all I'm saying. Fantastic show. So happy to have you guys on here. I've been your guest host, Benari Poulton. A big thank you to Nagin. I'd like to thank our producer, Julia Linden, sound engineer, Stephanie Aguilar, and all the wonderful people at HeadGum. Theme music was written by Gabi Alter. And thank you to you, all our listeners out there.
That was a HeadGum podcast.